Okay, so when I put the title down, I thought this will be a really interesting title, and now I looked at it again and I thought, oh my gosh, it sounds so boring. So basically what I want to speak about is something that's actually really interesting in the sense that it is an insight that has been brewing over the last couple of years in the field of quantum machine learning, which I here define as doing just normal machine learning, so learning from data with quantum computers. And so this insight really changes the way we think about things, and it basically gives us a whole theory that we can now connect to what we are doing and where we can start exploring, like on a very, very much deeper level, what's actually happening in quantum machine learning, at least in the part that I'll be talking about, and I'll define this like properly. Yes, and before I start, I want to give you actually exactly the summary of the whole argument I want to make, so there's no surprise, and you can judge yourself if you want to, like, maybe get a coffee in some section. So in supervised machine learning, which is one flavor of machine learning, but the biggest and the best understood, so to speak, we train models that are just usually functions with data so that the model captures a relation between inputs and target outputs. So far, I think most people will know this about machine learning. And in quantum machine learning, so there were a lot of approaches, how to quantize this thing, or how to put this quantum term in front of this. The early approaches were very often just to use something like HHL or some like interesting algorithm that we know there's speed ups, try to find a machine learning problem where this docs to or where this maps to, and then see if we can speed up algorithms in machine learning. And since then, I think things have matured a lot more. So we don't just use this, this is the approach that every quantum computing person does, right? With classical algorithms, just like see if we can do SHOR or HHL. But so since then, people have turned this a little bit around and have thought about this idea to use a variation circuit, so a parameterized quantum circuit that also like kind of somehow encodes inputs, so not only parameters, but also inputs as a model. And now since a couple of years, people are happily, creating software frameworks, training models, observing things, comparing things, and a lot of empirical studies are going on. And slowly also now theory is catching up to really understand if we replace like a neural network with a quantum circuit, what is actually happening? Where's the magic? Is there actually any magic? And we're slowly like narrowing down where something could happen in some sense. And so what I want to talk about here is basically a link that makes this analysis very beautiful. And that is the statement that these, I call them here circuit learners. So to be honest, I'm testing a new word. So in the literature, you find these quantum circuits that are trained like machine learning models as variational quantum classifiers, circuit-centric quantum classifiers, as quantum neural networks, more and more. So this term shifts at the moment, and this is maybe the dominant one. Parameterized quantum circuits for machine learning, so all of those. And I thought, oh gosh, all of these names I'm not very happy with, so I'll try here now, circuit learners. Then they are linear models in a very specific feature space, and more about this just now. And so why is this important? Well, this is first of all an argument of why we shouldn't call them quantum neural networks, because neural networks are very nonlinear models, so the mass looks very different. But like on a positive note is machine learning, and especially studies in the 90s and early 2000s, were all about these linear models in high-dimensional spaces. So machine learning has a very, very solid and beautiful theory about those models. And to apply this theory now to the quantum computing side is basically what we're starting to do with the link that I'm kind of trying to sketch here. And just as a teaser, for example, this theory tells us that just training basically a quantum circuit with variational parameters is maybe in many, many situations actually not the best idea. And another one is that, we always try to like look at these variational circuits of how expressive they are and how big they are and so on and so forth. But this approach tells us very much that this variational part of the algorithm is not important at all. We can completely replace it with classical optimization. The only thing that remains from the quantum circuit is the data encoding part. So this seems to be where we have to look hard at in some sense. And then since I start with the last slide, so I'll also give you the further reading slide now. So I think first traces about this idea of understanding quantum models or quantum algorithms for machine learning as linear models in high-dimensional spaces were kind of in these two papers. So this first paper really, I think you can say, kicked off quantum machine learning in general. So it's kind of an important one, following still like a little bit the old logic. And then there were these two papers in close succession, so from us and IBM, that kind of like had a first go at this link. Then these two papers I want to highlight because I think they are absolutely beautiful examples. So the first one from, again, IBM, the second one from Google team, that show that this theory can be used for completely different perspectives on what's actually better in quantum models or not, or where can we look for these advantages. And then what I'll refer to a lot is this overview that I put out a couple of months ago. And I think Michael actually asked me to like speak about this paper. So this is the one I'll refer to. Okay, cool. So since I see, okay, at least a few zeros, let's talk very quickly about machine learning, but not about the cats and dogs introduction or something that you might have heard before, but more, what is the mathematical problem that we want to solve? So I assume that all of you like this language probably most because it's the most precise. First, there's a picture. So in machine learning, we usually have data. Often we model it as being drawn from a certain distribution that we usually don't know of in real life, obviously. Then we've got a model, and this model could be, again, a probability distribution we're trying to match or we're trying to like find. But I'll talk here about supervised learning, and there most often the model can be written as a function that maps inputs to outputs. And then we have a cost. And the cost basically, so this is something we can choose, but there are very standard choices like least squares or whatever. So, and the cost tells us how well is a certain model from a family doing on a certain subset of data. And the goal of machine learning would be to find the model that minimizes the cost on all data. So in some sense, the expected cost over this distribution of data. Since we don't have that, machine learning is born from a practical problem, and this is just the mathematical modeling of this practical problem. We usually solve actually a proxy problem, which means we find the model that minimizes the cost on a small training set. So if you've ever like trained a neural network or something, this is what you do, but this is what you want to do. So going one step deeper, so now the whole thing in a little bit more mathematical language, just because I want you to see this expression once, because I'll get back to it. So this problem, so I'm not talking about this real problem we want to solve. You could formulate it as given a distribution over data samples, given a model family that's, for now, there's machine learning where you don't have parameters in the model family. But for now, we just like think of a parameterized function here. And depending on, you know, picking parameters means to pick a model from that family. And then we have a loss function that compares what's the model saying as a prediction and what's the target label. And now the goal is to find the parameters that solve this minimization problem. And what you see here is basically just the expected loss over all our data distribution, right? This is how well your model does on all the data we've seen. And now the other problem that you actually really solve is the following, given some data samples. So now this is a finite set and all the other ingredients, you now minimize basically, you know, the empirical estimation of this average loss. And now I put this term here that you know quite well, probably from linear regression and all the problems that also physicists do a lot, which is that if we kind of like want to solve this problem up here, but we only have this part, what can happen is that you overfit to the subsample of data that you see. And this is usually a regularization term, and regularization just means to kind of bias your cost function or your cost function in some sense so that you don't do this overfitting. And so solving this problem, so if you ever hear that machine learning is, there's not much theory behind it, then this Google regularized empirical risk minimization. So this is the most elegant and simple formulation of supervised machine learning problems. And you can do a lot of math with these kind of minimization optimization problems. So that's what you want to solve when you train a model, mathematically speaking. And then lastly, just to say, so most of you have heard about deep learning and neural networks. So they are just one choice of these three blocks that you can make. So usually your data is very big. Deep learning is performing very well on human generated data like pictures or audio. So it's often also very specific data. And then the models are most often neural networks, but that's not so important in deep learning. More important is that they are highly composable. So they're very modular and they are very differentiable. So you might have heard of backpropagation in neural networks, which is just a very efficient way to implement differentiation on these neural networks, which you can use for gradient descent based training. And then you get like these very complicated optimization landscape. And one of the big breakthroughs was obviously to kind of see how can we train these huge models. And there was actually a big surprise happening. Not only can we train very, very large models, but it seems the bigger they are, the better they generalize. And by generalization, I mean, if we train them on a small data set, the better they actually also do on this real problem that we want to solve. And I think it's one of the most exciting questions at the moment in science why this happens. So, but the model class that I'm, so I mean, people obviously, they love neural networks, they love deep learning. So quantum machine learning people talk all the time about neural networks. But actually the model class that is much more interesting for us in my view is the model class of linear models. And in the most abstract sense, you can just say that, you know, your data X is in some kind of Hilbert space. So you've got an inner product defined, and then you kind of take the inner product with another vector from that vector space. Obviously these are just like normal RN vectors, then this is just the normal inner product, the dot product. And these linear models kind of give rise to very simple decision boundaries, we say. So for example, if you have a classification problem, then the boundary in your data space where you would, the model would switch from the one answer to the other answer, the decision boundary, the linear, but kind of guarantees that your cost is very often a convex and you can just do convex optimization. Now, the last little bit about this is that in the 90s, as I say, I mean, linear models have been around forever, linear regression. This is nothing else than linear regression. But so what kind of the 90s have brought us are these kernel methods where we think implicitly that our data is mapped to a very high dimensional space, often actually an infinite dimensional space. And so this I will call a linear model in feature space. And the beauty of these kernel methods is basically you have still your very simple problem in a very high dimensional space, but there are a lot of tricks basically to compute in your low dimensional space to solve this high dimensional optimization problem. And just in a nutshell, so this link that I want to draw that quantum models are also linear models basically means that we can optimize them in very low dimensional spaces. We can do all sorts of machine learning in Hilbert spaces that are really large by just like staying in very low dimensional spaces. So this trick is very, very interesting for us, obviously, because we also know like that the Hilbert spaces do not give us power per se, because we can actually do computations in them. Okay. If you ever want to interrupt me, just do so. Otherwise, I just keep on chatting forever. So now the second point was, so in quantum machine learning, lots of things have been done. You can do, for example, you can outsource the optimization to a quantum computer. You could speed up a neural network. You could do all sorts of things. But so one of the biggest approaches at the moment is to use quantum circuits as models, as I say. And so these always have like these three parts. They can be intermixed, but it's nice to separate them if you want to build theory. Of somehow your data has to go into your quantum computer, then the processing happens, and then your result would always be a measurement. And for now, I always talk about basically a model generating a prediction by just, we take the expectation value of the model. So that means actually if on a real quantum computer, you want to run a model, you have to run a lot of shots. So you have to like repeat your algorithm a lot of times. So we can only estimate a prediction on a quantum computer, but that's complexity that for now I'll just put under the rug. Going one step like further down. So in terms of a circuit, you can think of the quantum circuit that we actually use as a model as consisting of some unitary that depends on data. So that can you can feed data into that unitary. You can do this in exactly the same way as in variation circuits. For example, you could just take Pauli X rotations, and instead of encoding like a trainable parameter, you encode a data point, a data feature. And then you usually have this other part of the algorithm. And most people think at the moment of having this trainable, and then basically the whole quantum circuit can be trained. And as most of you know, we have really nice frameworks by now, for example, Penny Lane, TensorFlow Quantum, Yao, where we can actually train quantum circuits just out of the box by making use of automatic differentiation and quantum gradients and stuff. So it's quite cool. So this is the setup. Just to give you a little example, because I really like, I think it just like hits a little bit home. So what we're actually looking at here. So if you have a single qubit and you encode your data into Rx rotation, and then your unitary is now an arbitrary single qubit unitary, so rotation with three angles. So in a picture, you can see say that the data will be kind of mapped to the blossphere. So obviously the model will only map one data point at a time, but I just plotted all of them for now. And then this rotation would just like rotate your entire data set on the blossphere. And now the measurement kind of defines a decision boundary here, this white region on the blossphere. So for example, this data point would now be blue. It would have a classification as blue. And also quite nice is to just write down what this model actually looks like. And you can show that this is literally the function that it gives rise to. So I'm also saying this that, I don't know, I guess you all like, I don't know if you're experienced researchers or not, but a lot of students just like look at these quantum circuits and they think that the magic is going on. But for example, this model literally just has this function class, and you can just train these sine functions here. And the interesting thing is, but this is a book for a different day, that even if you increase the number of qubits, if you keep your embedding as simple as this, you will always only like learn some very, very simple cosine function of x. So you have to be really careful with what models you're building and how expressive your models are. Or in other words, the model expressivity, so this function class here, is not necessarily related to how expressive your circuit is. So this is really important. I'm also saying these, I see on the archive all the time, like studies on expressivity of circuits, and then they link it to machine learning. I'm always thinking it's not the right measure, I guess, or not the only one at least. Okay, so now let's get to a statement that circuits are linear models, and I use my picture math here. So this is like our circuit again. And I basically just write down, you know, the linear algebra or like matrix vector multiplication you would have to perform to simulate this in a very, very stupid simulator. So you would start with like an amplitude state vector in the ground state, and then you would apply these two unitaries. And then obviously you just like take this like quadratic form here where you sandwich the measurement observable. So this would be the Mathematica's correction. And now if you look at this, you rightly ask, okay, where is this linear? So for example, it's not linear in X because of this S of X. It's also not necessarily linear in the whole state here that I create, because the state appears here again. So there's something quadratic going on. It's most likely not linear in these parameters. So we need to like shuffle things around a little bit to make that claim, but we can do this in the picture notation. So let's go into density matrix notation, which means just take a trace and then you use the cyclic property of the trace. You shuffle this to the other side and call this rho of X. This is what I did basically in this slide. It's just like, you know, different notation. And so wait, let me just like check here. And then I do one more trick just to simplify things. And I think this is conceptually really important and actually quite helpful. Let's just, combine these like purple and orange matrices to like just an orange one. So basically the circuit before the measurement, you reinterpret it as a different measurement, right? Which is something we do in practice all the time. So usually you have a very simple measurement on a quantum computer and you rotate your state into the right measurement basis in order to implement like a more complicated measurement. So this is basically our mathematical description of the model. And so now if you stare at this very hard, so it is a bit of a strange inner product, but it is nevertheless an inner product. So the trace is like the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product in the space of complex valued matrices. So if you consider the space of complex valued matrices as your feature space and the trace as the inner product, you actually exactly have a linear model, just in a slightly weird space in some sense. And so here also the note that these circuit learners are linear in, what do I mean by linear, or linear models are linear? They're always linear in this like argument here, so in M, or also like kind of in this feature state, but not in theta and X. So this is important, but that's all we need basically. If there are no questions, let me just check what I have here. So now we're getting to kernel theory. And I also stay a little bit shallow in this one because kernel theory is like deep and beautiful and it has a lot of functional analysis and it's my favorite part of machine learning, to be honest, but it's, and even after years, I find it really hard to follow some of the results. So I stay a little bit more superficial here. The kernel theory, I said, is kind of a theory that talks about what we can do with these linear models and how we can avoid basically having linear models in high dimensional spaces. And you will immediately agree this linear model here lives in a really, really high dimensional space because that obviously goes with the dimension of the Hilbert space. A quick note, when I say kernel theory or kernel methods, I'm talking about a really, really large field. But the most popular representative is a support vector machine. And most of you might not know kernel methods, but might know support vector machines. And just to make this link very briefly, there are some people, and also this like absolutely beautiful textbook here, like defines a support vector machine in a very general way. So just as these linear models in high dimensional spaces and plus some like convex assumptions on optimization or something like that. But most people define support vector machines as such models, but then a very specific optimization where you optimize the margin of data points to the decision boundary. So this is just a, you know, not to get confused. So for now, I will use support vector machines if I use them as just very general kernel methods. Okay, cool. So what is now the real beauty of how can we compute in this high dimensional feature space? And the answer, and this is why it's called kernel theory, is through a kernel, and the kernel is a positive definite function. And it basically is just the inner product of two of these feature vectors in our feature space. And so in some sense, you can think of the kernel always as a similarity measure. And the point is that for every feature space F, you will have a kernel, because you can just define it like that. You have an inner product, so that's fine. And the other way around, you know that for every kernel, so every positive definite distance measure between two data points, x, x dash, you will always have a feature space so that you can write it this way. So this is like really nice. And so the point is that these kernels might be really easy to compute. So it could be just a Gaussian of like, you know, x minus x dash or something like that. But the whole theory you can do in these like feature spaces. And this is like what's interesting. And it's actually very similar to quantum computing in some sense that in quantum computing, you describe everything through expectations and measurements, which are always somehow inner products. But what we do in some sense, we compute in these like really high dimensional Hilbert spaces. So there's a really nice analogy between the two. And so there are two now, so I only sketched two results from kernel theory that are very, very famous, but there are hundreds and millions and they're all interconnected. But these ones here will be really important for quantum machine learning, how we think about this. And the first result is the representer theory. And that says that you can show that the model, so this model here, F, I sometimes drop this little like F of W, that the model that minimizes regularized empirical risk, as a reminder, this is the problem we want to solve in learning, can always be written as this linear combination here of these like kernel functions. And so the kernel function takes the X that we want to evaluate our model at, and it takes XM, which are the data points from before. So it's just like basically kernel. So in some sense, you can think of this as a distance measure between X and the training data we've seen, and then like some kind of like coefficient in front of this. And these coefficients here you can train. So instead of training W, you now train these alphas here. And so you have reparametrized in some sense your model in this way. And the beauty of this is that this here lives in a possibly infinite dimensional space. This one here is just M terms, right? And if you can compute the kernel efficiently, then you're fine. So this is super important. The second one is the empirical risk minimization problem itself. So the training problem itself. So not only does the model look like this, we can also find this model so we can solve this minimization problem by solving a problem that is likewise low dimensional and really, really beautiful for optimization. Let me try to explain, first of all, why it's finite dimensional, but this should be almost apparent. So this one here is this loss term that you had before. So it's the average loss over your training data. And simply by putting your ansatz here, this thing in here, you know that this loss will only have, M terms. So it will be a low dimensional, totally computable function. And you know, if this one here is convex, so this loss function, then this part here of the optimization problem is convex. The second term comes from the blue regularization term we had before. And also here we have to see like what happens now if we do kernel methods. So how can we basically minimize the L2 norm of this vector here in this high dimensional space? And it turns out also that we can do with kernels. So we just get like this kind of like, it's basically a matrix vector matrix vector multiplication, like which is written as scalar. So also this part depends on the kernel. So basically we can solve this like high dimensional problem with low dimensional tools. And the nice thing is if kappa is convex, is positive definite, then also this part is convex. So we end up with really nice convex optimization with a lot of guarantees, you know, like a minimum exists, is unique, we can find it and so on and so forth. Okay, and then the last thing is basically just to plug in the quantum part into this kind of like range of results. And again, there are others, but these are the most important. So now we have this quantum linear model. So computations in this space, so we never really have to like run this model really. We only have to be able to evaluate this kernel, and the kernel in our inner product looks exactly like this. And this is the quantity you can just get with the swap test, or like there's easy ways on a quantum computer to get basically some kind of overlap. So it's, this is like totally doable. Also on near-term devices very often. And you realize if everything about our model we know depends on this, we have nothing to do with this measurement. And by extension, we totally ignore the variational part. We're not interested in that because we're not training the model anymore in this variational part. We now can like work with the kernel. So we know that if I kind of like have this model and I try to find the best measurement here, we know that the best measurement for learning has this form here. So not actually a very simple like shape it has. And again, we know that we can find and minimize this model by solving this equation, which again only depends on these kernel parts. So if this is confusing, just think of, we can literally just run an SVM with scikit-learn or your favorite machine learning framework. The only thing that has to be quantum is that the kernel, so this kappa function, has to be computed on a quantum computer. Everything else can be really nicely done with classical machine learning, which is also a bit sad, right? A little bit of the magic is gone somehow, because if you want to look into that paper I was talking about, it goes a bit more into depth. So to show all of those things, and this is more like just going through classical machine learning and kind of like plugging in the quantum models everywhere, but the plugging in is a very trivial part here. To show this, you have to kind of like construct this picture where this is your space of quantum models. This is this feature space I was talking about of these complex variant matrices. And what you need for this theory is something called another feature space that's called the reproducing kernel Hilbert space. Turns out it's this, the same functions as the space of quantum models live in there. So it's a bit strange to get your head around this, but most of the proofs are done in this space. And I think it's a big deterrent for people because, I mean, I don't know, it took me like really years to understand what the space even is. Maybe to give you a very brief intuition, the space here contains, okay, this is already like a bit crazy, like this notation, but like the space contains functions where you fix one of the slots in your kernel with a data point. So not your training data, but just any point of your data domain. So if your data is pictures, that will be a picture that you put in there. And so the functions living in there are linear combinations of these kernel things, kernel, you know, single slot kernel functions. And so how do the functions then in general look like? So if you say like, we now construct a function that has these images, for example, that the kernel is centered around, and we have a Gaussian kernel, which just looks like this distance measure here. And then we add or take a linear combination where all the coefficients are one for now, we get like this function here. So in some sense, this reproducing kernel Hilbert space tells you what are the functions a quantum computer could learn. And you can literally just look at it as these like linear combinations of these kernel functions. And by changing what your kernel is, for us, changing what's the distance measure between two quantum states, we can, for example, if we widen this, we can change the function class itself. So we're really looking into the function class of quantum models here. Yes, and then I'm kind of like almost wrapping up, but so now I promise that this link means a lot now for how we actually do quantum machine learning with these near-term ideas, these circuit learners or quantum neural networks, or how you want to call them. And so this gives us really a different or almost equivalent framework to doing this. So basically, if you have your normal variational circuit training, you have a cost that depends on these trainable parameters in your circuit, and it's non-convex, it could be any cost function, and you find the minimum of that. So in the picture that I try to like propagate, this means basically learning the measurement, right? Because I've summarized the measurement and the variation circuit together. And you will find an optimum if you're lucky somewhere in the space of measurements. But the kernel-based training has a different parameterization, and you know the cost is convex. So everything is like beautiful here. And plus you have the guarantee that the global optimum is in this function class that you can learn, because we know the shape of the final model, so to speak. And so, now you can say, okay, like, so on the one hand, I have an easy optimization problem where I can find the best model. On the other hand, I have a difficult optimization problem where I don't find the best model. So there's some hullabaloo out there. So why would I ever do the variational circuit training? And so I asked myself, so I thought like, okay, why do people actually do neural networks instead of kernel methods? Because if you have all these nice guarantees in kernel methods, why not just doing them? And here's the crux. So if you compare kernel methods classically with neural networks classically, you get a much better scaling of the neural networks. So I have here a little plot. So this is a bit non-trivial how I got these curves. So I basically like counted how often do you have to evaluate your model. If you do, I think, like so many steps of training, and then you do a bit of prediction. So it's basically the number of models you have to evaluate. In the quantum case, it will be the number of quantum circuits you have to evaluate. That's in the plot. And you see here that the neural network, basically the number of function evaluations increases only linearly with the size of the data set. That makes total sense, because if you train something, you have to at least touch every data point once, right? So training will always be linear in the size of the data, unless you have a compression algorithm that you didn't factor into your runtime consideration. So that's that. And kernel methods is here in red, and it doesn't matter if it's a quantum kernel or a classical kernel, how often do you have to call the kernel? Grows quadratically in the size of the data set. Why, if you're interested in this? Because basically of this thing here, you have this like pairwise inner product. This is why it's quadratic in the size of the data. There are other methods out there, approximation methods, and they're really interesting, but now we're talking about vanilla kernel methods. So what are now the other two lines? So basically I made this plot and then I thought, let me plot what variation circuits would cost. And then I expected the same thing, right? I expected the variation circuits to be in the blue line and quantum kernel methods to be in red. And I thought this was now the answer why people use variation circuits over quantum kernel methods. But what you find is actually the orange curve. And just because it was so depressing, I kind of put the green curve, made a couple of assumptions that make quite a bit less depressing and put the green curve here as well. So to train variation circuits on quantum hardware, you use these so-called parameter shift rules. And these rules, for these rules, you have to evaluate your quantum circuit twice for every parameter you train. Now, if you make the assumption that the parameters grow with the size of the data, so in some sense, more data, you need a bigger model, you need more parameters. So the linear parameter scaling here, then this is the scaling you get from variation circuits. And I checked it for small examples, and quantum kernel methods were like 10 times faster in terms of the evaluations of quantum circuits than the variation circuits. So why did I put the green line is because there's an assumption here. So maybe variation circuits need only very little amount of parameters. So maybe the scaling doesn't happen. So then you could in principle be better than these kernel methods. But then again, you can also like do something clever about the kernel methods and approximate things. So so I looked at this and I thought that 95% of quantum machine learning literature is at the moment training quantum neural network, you know, what they call quantum neural networks. But meanwhile, these quantum neural networks are in fact, most of them are these kernel methods, and training can be done classically a lot faster. So it's quite a big thing takeaway here. Sure, and then I conclude just with a little kind of like outlook, because so now I haven't really talked about what these quantum kernels look like. So we just know they have this like form here of these inner products. But under reasonable assumptions we have put down on the slide, you don't have to like read them. We can actually, or very typical quantum kernels that we're at the moment producing. So these kernels depend on how you encode your data, right? What's rho of X basically. You can write them as these like high dimensional Fourier series. And there's a lot of interesting theory hidden in there. One of the reasons is that actually we know that we can quantum models, we can decompose them in very, very low degree Fourier series. So the Fourier representation is extremely natural for these quantum models, probably if we have wave functions. I mean, so there's probably a much deeper connection than I'm even seeing here. But so we know that the kernel looks like this, and a lot of my work at the moment goes into understanding what does this kernel actually tell us about generalization and about how good learning can be. And so this is like kind of a really like open topic to understand what kernels are also good. These are kind of some visualizations that I skip. Okay, cool. Yeah. So I hope this was, you know, I basically just spoke to the screen, but I hope that it was helpful for you.
Great. Let's all thank Maria for a really interesting talk. Do we have any questions? Okay, maybe I can start. So from if what I understand from what you said, that in these kernel methods the thing you're changing is like the encoding of your data, right? And then the way you always just evaluate, given an encoding, you just evaluate the same circuit to and then you do this classical optimization. But can you say a bit more about the type of encodings of the data you can do and like how they would work, and maybe an example or something?
Sorry, I have to dig through this preamble here. You don't mind, just have the equations on the slide. So I would say that most people, so there's, I think, three different kinds of encoding that's around there. So there's one that one could call amplitude encoding, where you just associate. So we always assume that we have data given as an n-dimensional vector, just, you know, real valued and whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's interesting stuff you can do with graph structured data, but that's not important. So you could now encode it such that the amplitude vector represents your data vector. So this will be called amplitude encoding. And this is used a lot with these HHL speedups and you know, like to do some very compressed encoding. But if you think about it, if you kind of like then compute what this quantum kernel here is, a very, very stupid quantum kernel. I think it's just a linear kernel with a square factor somewhere. So that might not be so interesting if you use this approach. The second one will be called basis encoding, where you encode data into qubits. So, you know, you binarize it and then you associate it with like basis state, which is also not a very good kernel in the sense if you use this framework, because basically a data point will always be mapped to a new dimension in your Hilbert space. And so you can't really get like any interesting overlaps here. There will always be zero or one, and there will only be one if it's the same data point, right? So mm-hmm. in terms of kernel theory, this is like useless. So there's the third class, which you could call hardware efficient ansatz or hardware efficient kernel. And practically you just encode into Pauli rotation. So usually the assumptions that I think are quite general and quite beautiful to work with is that every data feature, so every XI from this vector here, is encoded by just a gate. You can call it time evolution. I start calling it time evolution encoding because you just replace the time in this evolution here. And so if you have that, you can make things more interesting by, after encoding a feature, you just like have a general unitary or some learnable unitary or do something, then you encode the next feature and so on and so forth. And then lastly, what I wanted to say is if you repeat this gate, then also interesting things happen. Basically, you make your Fourier spectrum here much more interesting. So, you know, so that's the ideas, but maybe we're on the wrong track. Maybe there's an non-obvious solution how to encode data that makes things a lot more interesting.
Okay, so in this last example, you're saying that so like this G is fixed here, and then you just like depending on the XI, you're doing this rotation like a different amount of time or something like that.
Yes, and that would just mean your Pauli, it's an angle in your Pauli gate, for example, if this is a Pauli yeah. matrix, right? But you could mm-hmm. be more general. Yeah.
And you said it like, sorry, go on.
So by the way, also like when I talked about quantum models have this Fourier series decomposition. So what frequencies you have in your Fourier series depends very much on the eigenvalue spectrum of this G. So it's quite interesting. Actually, there's a nice relation between the model class and these encoding gates that is also very useful to do theory, actually.
And you kind of want to have some like non-trivial overlaps in your this kernel because this is kind of giving you that.
And that's a big question. People always say like, yeah, but Hilbert space is too big. But mm-hmm. in classical kernel theory, the spaces are also super big. So you have to make sure you encode your data into a corner of that space, but in a clever manner. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. Yeah, otherwise you're right. If you just have a random encoding, the overlap will always be zero. And
yeah. And you said like this is like hardware efficient, and like so how deep are the circuits, and like have like, you know, how realistic is it to run? Like, do you think there's an advantage to these methods on near-term devices?
It's so hard to tell, but like, so first of all, I'm personally not so super interesting in this topic because I think at the moment the regime is not interesting for hardware, because also the kernels you compute, they are really rough estimates, and then you can show again like that you can't learn really nicely, so it's really hard mm-hmm. to combine like all of those with noise. But let's put it like that. You can use this model to construct circuits that are implementable in hardware at the moment.
So yeah. Okay, but
you don't have to raise it. You know, like if no one has questions, you don't have to like entertain me. That's what I want to say.
No, I'm interested. Let's. I shouldn't just only ask questions. So, does anyone else have any questions? Okay, maybe one more for me then. It's like so can you maybe even in the classical case, could you give me like a example of a real world problem which is like very well suited to these kernel methods? Because I think I understand like the abstract idea of what's mm-hmm. going on, but I don't have like an example in mind of how.
Yeah. So anything. The problem is if you use vanilla kernel methods, you've got this quadratic scaling in the data size. So you can't use big data, right? If you have a million data points, a million times a million is prohibitive. Actually, this was the first time, working with kernel methods for the first time, I really understand what a problem quadratic scaling can be. Because as a quantum researcher, it's always like quadratic scaling is lame. We want exponential speedups. But I start realizing the moment you work with data, nothing is allowed to be quadratic or you're totally lost. And so this is a side note, but so for small scale problems, I mean, these kernel methods, SVMs, have been used for like 20 or 30 years absolutely everywhere. They don't get as much headlines as neural networks because they're older and they're like less used in like industry problems at the moment. So it's more like small scale data analysis. But small scale, you know, 10,000 data points is still fine. But then I don't know if this is like important or not, but so they're making a comeback at the moment in the deepest like machine learning theory, because when people try to understand this problem of deep learning, they start like understanding now that deep neural networks actually correspond to kernels in a certain asymptotic regime. Now all of a sudden they can use all that kernel theory again to understand neural networks. So I think this is like really, this is a really interesting space then to put the quantum worlds into, because we also have this few interpretations of them as quantum neural networks and as quantum kernel methods now. Cool.
Okay, so one last chance for questions. Okay, if not, let's all thank Maria again for a really nice talk.
Thanks, guys, and have a good time. See you sometime again in the future in person.